Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shekman. Indeed, we are living through complicated political times, a time when ideas like post-truth and alternative facts are seriously debated on the nightly news, a time when a private bodyguard of the president is sent to fire a member of the government who was appropriately confirmed by the U.S. Senate, a time when the press, the courts, and other institutions which support our separation of powers are under siege. But haven't we been here before? From the earliest Alien and Sedition Acts through to the modern era and internment, McCarthyism, and Nixon, we as individuals and as institutions have proven to be resilient. Sinclair Lewis is reported to have said that when fascism comes to America, it will come wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. But to the extent that we're aware of it, can we be protected from it? On Wall Street, four of the scariest words you can hear are "this time it's different." Today, we're going to talk about how scary those four words can be, not on Wall Street, but in Washington. Joining me to talk about this is Timothy Snyder. He is the Levin Professor of History at Yale University, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his new book, On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Timothy Snyder, thanks so much for joining us.
Very glad to be with you.
As we look at the political landscape today, is there anything that is fundamentally different about the dangers that we face today that are fundamentally more powerful than dangers we have faced at other times as a democracy and as a republic?
Okay, that's a big question. Let me take it from the other end. I think the dominant American tendency is to imagine that whatever history is throwing at us, we're ready for it because of who we are. And what I'm trying to do in the book is to turn that around and to say that the people who founded our republic saw the world in the opposite way. The people who founded our republic were very skeptical about human nature and used the examples that they knew, which were classical examples, to demonstrate that democracy and republics usually fail, usually fall into oligarchy or into empire. And they gave us the institutions that we have, flawed though they were, flawed though they remain, in order to guide against the tendency of humans to lapse. So what I then try to do in the book is go through the 20th century, go through the example of the founders couldn't have known, and try to show how modern politics, modern attempts to create republics and democracies have often failed. And I do that as a gesture towards us to say, look, the people in Czechoslovakia in 1948 who saw a communist coup, or the people in Germany in 1933 who saw the rise of Hitler, were really not so different from us. And some of their institutions were actually not so different from ours. And in some respects, they were probably better than we. They certainly had longer attention spans, and probably they had, at least in the case of Germany, a better press. Now, what's different and what's the same? I mean, I think what's largely similar with the 20th century is globalization failure. There was a first globalization for the 19th to 20th century, which had its opponents, had its contradictions, and which ended up in a First World War, Great Depression, and Second World War. We had a second globalization in the late 20th century, which has now generated its own contradictions, its own inequalities, its own opponents. And for me, the question is whether we can learn enough from the 20th century that we can try to head these things off. The big difference for me would be how people think about the future. So the grand opponents of liberalism, democracy, republics in the early 20th century were people who had a very clear idea of an alternative, whether that was communism or whether that was fascism. And when they went after factuality, it was the name of these grand alternatives. So fascists said, you know, your daily experience doesn't matter because the only thing which matters is your collective experience with a larger group. The communists said your daily experience doesn't matter because what matters is a vision of the future. What's different today and is threatening in a different way is that the people who are trying to destroy democracy or have destroyed democracy, whether it's Russia or America or elsewhere, go after the truth without a vision of the future. They just say, I have my facts, you have your facts, and nothing, maybe at the end of the day, nothing is really true. And then that means that we can't really trust each other, which means that democracy becomes impossible in the long run. And it means resistance becomes impossible in the short run.
And that seems to be a fundamental part of the question, whether or not there is no vision of the future, or that the vision of the future is so divided, is so different, that that's a fundamental part of the problem.
So I guess I think that, you know, if you want to be really specific about the people who are running the United States right now, I think they have a vision of the future, and it's a vision of the future in which people named Trump and Kushner have an enormous amount of wealth, and other people don't. It's just that's not a vision of the future that you can really sell. I think the way that you know, if you want to be a nepotist and a kleptocrat, and a postmodern authoritarian, the way you deal with time is not by generating a big, glorious vision of the future, whether it's of a national collectivity or whether it's of a class collectivity like in the past. I think what you do instead is you turn time into a kind of spiral or a kind of cycle where you talk about, you know, making America great again, or you go back to the 1930s and talk about America first. You imagine some kind of past where everything was fine, and then you claim that the reason why everything is not fine now has to do with external enemies some of whom are in our midst, and that the immediate task then becomes getting at those external enemies that we can get our hands on. And that creates a different style of time because it stops us, or it's meant to stop us, from thinking about reform, from thinking about how we could be better or how the country could be better. It's meant to make us concentrate on these supposed threats, who are so great supposedly, so threatening to our way of life supposedly, that we forget what that way of life actually is supposed to be. So I think rather than giving us a vision of the future, because I mean, frankly, I think their vision of the future is just that their grandchildren have tons of money. What they give us instead is a kind of cycle where we're supposed to just be alarmed over and over again about enemies, external and internal.
To what extent, though, does this reflect a fundamental weakness in the body politic? This is not something that just happened overnight on the 9th of November, 2016, that the circumstances that created this existed before that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first, to give credit where credit is due. Mr. Trump has certain talents which allowed him to take advantage of the historical moment. One of them is his talent for public speaking. Another is his complete national nihilism, which means his willingness to cooperate with or at least accept the help, let's say, the help of foreign powers in becoming president of the United States. I think there are relatively few other people who would have done that with no stirrings of conscience. So, I mean, you know, he has certain assets, but yeah, there are things about the moment which make this possible. One of them, again, playing to Mr. Trump's strengths, was the way that we in the media and public life allowed politics to blur into entertainment, such that someone who was basically a reality television performer could run for president of the United States without us really noticing. You know, the reason he outclassed his Republican opponents is that he treated the whole thing as a television show, and the people in the television business thought this was great because ratings went up, and we didn't start to get critical about it, at least most of us, until very, very late in the day when we realized that television was going to become reality. Another underlying trend, which I think is only becoming apparent now, is the way in which the internet is now important than three-dimensional life, for lack of a better word. I mean, this is anecdotal and I can't prove it, but in my experience talking to people in the Midwest before the elections, it was really the first time that I felt like people were going to go out and do something in the real world, pull a lever in a booth, elect a president, based mainly on things that they were getting from very, you know, personalized, siloized feeds in the internet. That's different, and we really haven't gotten our minds around that. But then there's also just the basic fact of inequality. Somebody like Mr. Trump is only plausible in a situation where there is extreme inequality, because he can say, look, it's unfair, it's rigged, to use one of his favorite words, and therefore you need someone like me, a tough guy, a guy with lots of money, another oligarch, to shake things up and to fix the system. Of course, that claim is bogus in all kinds of ways, but it only works when people feel like the system is broken, because they're aware that there's great inequality. And of course, there is enormous inequality, and that's a fundamental problem.
And where is the analogy, as we look at how that's playing out, the politics and entertainment and the various points you've just made, to looking at other late-stage democracies and late-stage republics that have fallen apart in similar kinds of situations?
Well, so let me give an example from substance and an example from form. Whenever new communications technologies come around, people are very optimistic about them. People are optimistic about the printing press. And sure, the printing press gave us the Enlightenment, but only after 150 years of religious warfare. People are very optimistic about radio. And sure, you know, radio gave us charming public radio programs like the kind we like today, but only after fascism. So it's not surprising that the internet, rather than, you know, beating a simple path towards enlightenment, has had these twists and turns and led to unexpected and, you know, reactionary consequences. That's happened before. So that's an example from form. An example from substance would be how Mr. Trump uses these various technologies. So the way that he uses Twitter, or the way that he speaks live for that matter, is very redolent of the way that authoritarians and especially fascists in the 20s and 30s used language. The repetition of simple themes over and over again, the attempt to summon people into a kind of trance-like state where alternative reality is plausible. The specification of enemies, you know, inside the rally and then also inside the country, and then the physical or the metaphorical appeal to throw them out. These are all tendencies or habits, tactics, which are very familiar from the 1920s and the 1930s.
I want to talk a little bit about our institutions and our faith seemingly right now that our institutions will save us somehow, that the resiliency of those institutions, be it the courts or the press, will somehow be the saving grace of all of this.
Yeah, we're kind of in a funny position, right, where we're counting on the press to save the courts, to save the civil servants, to save the intelligence agencies, to save the generals, to save the kleptocrats, to save us from the fascists. You know, it's not a pretty picture. I would say that we have to look first of all at ourselves and ask ourselves what we're saying when we say that the institutions will protect us, because as someone who studies authoritarian regimes, what I notice is that both on the right and on the left, if you're trying to take apart a democratic regime, what you do is you pick off the institutions one after the other. So, I mean, a situation of pure revolution is actually very, very rare. What's much more common is for someone who comes to power, very often through elections, or where there's an election in the story, which is true for Hitler in 32, 33, true for the Czechoslovak communists. I just mentioned that because I use in the book in 46, 47, 48. And then once, as you come to power, you try to pick off the institutions one by one. So, you know, you go for the journalists first, or you go for the Supreme Court first, or you go for the parliament, or you go for an opposition party. And once you've picked off one institution, then it's all the easier to get the next institution. And so the story, the institutions are going to save us, is highly problematic, because what you actually have to do is realize every institution which is important is automatically under threat, and you have to be prepared to rally around any one of them. And in the meantime, help one which you're particularly sympathetic to or know something about or feel particularly comfortable with. I mean, I see the institutions will protect us as a kind of mental reflex which disperses our individual responsibility as citizens at the very moment we actually have to exercise that responsibility.
How much is that affected by all the noise that comes with that? One of the things you talk about is this idea of being calm when the unthinkable arrives. Difficult in the atmosphere of a perpetual boiler factory that we seem to be living in today.
I think at least a boiler factory, you probably, you know, you worked long hours, but you got to go home at some point. So two different things here. I think one thing one hears a lot is I'm tired, my friends are tired, we've been protesting, we've been doing things, but now we're tired. That's another thing we're not allowed to say. I mean, we're not allowed to say that America's exceptional because that makes us unexceptional. We're not allowed to say it can't happen here because that makes it happen here. We're not allowed to say the institutions will protect us because that weakens the institutions. Another thing I think we're just not allowed to say is we're tired. It's true that we're bombarded with stuff all the time. And it's also true that this is part of how authoritarian takeovers work. You get bombarded with lots of bad news so that you feel alone, intimidated, and you say, well, what can I do really? And the answer is we can do we can do a lot. It's ironically in the beginning of a moment, it's the beginning of authoritarian regime change where individual actions matter the most, because the regime usually can't change without a fair amount of consent from below, which is why lesson number one in the book is don't obey in advance. Now, the other part of your question, I think, is distinct. The be calm when the unthinkable arrives is about a very specific set of circumstances. For regime change, you basically need two things, aside from people who want to change the regime, which I'm pretty confident we have in power now. The first, as we just were talking about, was some degree of consent. So if you can restrain yourself from consenting, you're already doing a lot. But very often, the way that more consent is generated is by taking advantage of some kind of dramatic event, classically an act of terrorism. So Hitler in February of 1933 takes advantage of a terrorist attack on the German parliament to get a state of emergency declared, to suspend the civil rights of Germans. That's basically the moment when the Weimar Republic ceases to exist and the Nazi regime is formed. And that is unfortunately a template. It's an example. Modern tyrants are aware that they need and can use a certain amount of terrorism to affect regime changes of that kind, which is why towards the end of the book, in several of the lessons, I urge us to be aware that there's a politics to all of this, and to prepare ourselves so that when something that we regard as unthinkable does arrive, like, God forbid, another major terrorist attack, we realize that there's a politics to all this, and don't let ourselves be drawn into the emotional cycle where we're willing to give up our rights for what seems like a temporary moment. If there is a terrorist attack, what we have to defend will be our rights. Because if you let them go at a moment like that, it's very hard to get them back later on.
Certainly, if we look at the reaction, the country's reaction post 9/11, one can't be very optimistic about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 9/11 is a cautionary tale. I mean, we were attacked by one group of terrorists, and we allowed ourselves to be persuaded to fight a war against an unrelated country, which cost us enormous amounts of money. It led to American deaths and, you know, far more deaths of non-Americans, cost us our moral reputation, and basically bled away, which was supposed to be the American century, into the sand, and made terrorism more likely. So yeah, as you say, it wasn't 9/11 is very much a cautionary tale, and we need to treat it as such. I mean, I think what we should do is allow ourselves to be instructed by the extent to which many of us we're willing to concede things in 9/11, and then to recognize that, bad as that set of leaders was, and I was one of the people who was highly critical at the time, bad as that set of leaders was, this set of leaders is qualitatively worse. And were there to be such an event again, you know, God forbid, were there to be a similar event, I think it's very likely that this set of people would go for the whole kit and caboodle, would actually try to change regime, to suspend civil rights, to blame particular citizens. And, you know, that's something which the Bush and Cheney team did not do. For all of their faults, they didn't actually say we have to have some kind of state of emergency around the country. And for all of their faults, and again, they were many, they didn't blame Muslims in general or any group inside the United States. So we have to learn from 9/11 and get it much better next time, because the leaders are unfortunately much worse.
And yet you talk about the unthinkable. What's happened is that we constantly ratchet up what's unthinkable. And everything becomes possible at a certain point.
Yeah, that's something that we have to watch out for. I mean, I would put that in the particular the context of scandal. We have to wrench ourselves out of the entertainment paradigm and get ourselves back into the politics paradigm. Because, like, with the scandal with Trump and Russia, I mean, what else do we need at this point? It's already, I think, by leaps and bounds, no matter what we learn henceforth, the most profoundly disturbing political scandal we've had in modern times. It makes Watergate look like an elementary school kid kicking a can down the road. I mean, we have a presidential candidate whose first foreign policy speech was written by someone on the Russian payroll, whose Russia advisor was on the Russia payroll, whose campaign manager was not paid by Mr. Trump, but whose campaign manager had made an offer to Mr. Putin to soften up American democracy for Russian influence, whose campaign manager's previous job had been for Ukrainian kleptocrat who had to flee the country during the revolution against him. And then, you know, we have Mr. Sessions, the highest law enforcement official in the land, perjuring himself in his own confirmation hearings about contacts with Russia. Mr. Kushner doing the same for security clearance when it turns out the contact with Russia that he omitted to mention, according to the Post's reporting, was a contact with a Russian ambassador in which he was seeking a private back channel. As a private citizen, which is illegal among many other things, so that they could make some kind of deal which we would never know about with the Russians. I mean, it just keeps adding up and up and up and up. And we need to, you know, achieve some sober point from which we can judge all of this, because if we keep treating it like a reality television show where the next thing has to be bigger than the last thing, eventually it will run out, right? I mean, we've already reached the point where it's absurd and grotesque. So yeah, there's a lot in what you say.
And isn't that the goal for them, that it does run out, that people just become satiated by it and feel the need to move on?
I think that's their general approach to everything, but I think in this particular case, it has gotten under their skin a little bit because they know it's true, or some variant of it is true. You know, so there are things that, I mean, I think firing Mr. Comey was, you know, aside from the fact that it was unethical and it may turn out to be illegal if it's obstruction of justice, I think it was also a kind of miscalculation. I mean, I think some of the things that Mr. Kushner has done have been miscalculations. I think this is under their skin a little bit, and you know, when you see Mr. Trump's panicked tweets about how, you know, this is the fake news and the fake news is the enemy, and going back to that fake news, well, you know, maybe once or twice too often, I think we have the sense that, like, this is not just their normal tactic, is I think what you say. You just confuse and scatter. In this particular case, they seem to be desperate, and they seem to think the only way we can win is by getting people convinced that journalism is fake, which is what they want to do anyway for other reasons. But I mean, I see a specific concentration of panic on the Russia issue, which I don't see other places.
One of the things you talk about is the importance of recognizing moments. Talk a little bit about that, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where history comes in. Thanks for that question. You know, the whole on tyranny is a list of pieces of advice, of daily practice, things that most of us can do most of the time. But where it comes from is the intuition that history can help. You know, the intuition that we made a mistake in the last generation of setting history aside. We made a mistake of imagining that, that only good things could happen. We made a mistake raising the next generation to think that history was more or less going to proceed according to certain laws. And then what we can do with history is we can use it, as we and I have been talking about, to recognize certain patterns. And we can do it, we can use history to recognize a moment, you know, a moment where we see the outlines of things, we understand what some of the forces are, and the more you see the moment, the more you also see your own place in that moment. And once you see your own place in that moment, it's very hard to escape responsibility, because you realize that what you do actually matters. And so, you know, every moment is different. Every historical moment is different, but there are also certain resemblances, and we are in a certain kind of moment now. We're in a moment where a system could change. We're in a moment where our leader is pushing up against the walls, right? Where his personality, which I don't imagine will change, is pushing up against the constraints of a system which could change. And whether it does change is largely up to us, whether we like it or not. You know, I mean, there are various ways of turning your head and looking away, you know, talking about American exceptionalism or the institutions or, you know, whatever. But that doesn't change the fact that we are in this moment. Those are just ways of trying to shirk the responsibility. We're in a moment where what we do matters more than at other times. And if we figure that out fast enough, then we'll probably be okay.
How do we recognize that moment that it's too late, that we've gone over the Rubicon?
It's, I mean, the crucial thing is not to drift and get there yourself, right? I mean, if you're in a river where the current is pushing you towards a waterfall, you start swimming right away. You don't just say, I'm going to wait until I can hear, you know, the rushing rapids, or I'm going to wait until I can see the foam. You know, you start swimming right away. I mean, the point that I would emphasize is that there is a time limit where if you do nothing, it's going to become impossible for you to do something. You know, classically, that's between 1 and 3 years out. So once you know that there's that time limit, that then becomes one more reason to start acting now. Because if you do act now, you make it possible that Rubicon doesn't arrive. And that is, of course, what I want. I mean, when we're talking about historical moments and responsibility, we're talking about our ability to actually change things so that that particular future doesn't have to arise. Now, I don't really mean to dodge your question. I mean, I would say for most of us, the moment where protest becomes illegal would be a big threshold. And for most of us, the threshold where protest becomes potentially lethal would be a big threshold. Because we're not there yet, it's important for us to take advantage of the opportunities that we have now.
Coming back a little bit to institutions, what do you see as the nexus then with the other aspects of government? I mean, the nexus with Congress. Where does Article 1 fit into this equation?
Well, I mean, the checks and balances just don't work as well as we would like. The main check on the executive is supposed to be the legislature. But in practice, you know, in the last several administrations, it's been the party politics rather than the actual institutions which have created the friction or the resistance. You know, and now we're in this odd situation, I think dangerous situation, where one party controls most of the important instances of power, but doesn't actually have a meaningful political program, at least in the traditional sense in a democratic system where you come to power with policies and those policies are popular and therefore you try to win midterm elections. What concerns me about the present setup are two things. The first is that the legislature is not monitoring the executive the way that one would expect. I personally am struck by how little attention Republicans in Congress are paying to the Russia problem. It seems to me that if there is some chance that the head of state and the commander of chief is a traitor, that one would make that the first priority, sort that out first, and then move on to other priorities, regardless of your party. But the second thing that concerns me is that in the middle term, when you have this setup where the executive doesn't check the legislature and the legislature doesn't check the executive, why then does anybody in that equation continue to care about democracy? You know, neither the president nor the Congress actually have policies to offer that are popular beyond a certain limited base. And, you know, so in a way they've won when they shouldn't have won. And this goes back to your earlier question about, you know, the problems of American democracy, which include too much money in politics, gerrymandering, voter suppression laws, and the Electoral College, you know, which have led us to a situation where, you know, a party which got fewer votes controls everything and doesn't really have a program. And so that then creates, you know, the kinds of temptations which the founders were worried about. If you don't really have anything to offer and you're in power and elections are coming, why do you like elections? So that, you know, that troubles me. That troubles me rather a lot.
Timothy Snyder, his book is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Timothy, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.